Chapter 24, The Restoration. The loser now will be later to win. Hovering backstage. It's rare that you see an artist in his 30s or 40s able to really contribute something amazing, Jobs declared as he was about to turn 30. That held true for Jobs in his 30s, during the decade that began with his ouster from Apple in 1985. But after turning 40 in 1995, he flourished. Toy Story was released that year, and the following year, Apple's purchase of Next offered him re-entry into the company he had founded. In returning to Apple, Jobs would show that even people over 40 could be great innovators. Having transformed personal computers in his 20s, he would now help to do the same for music players, the recording industry's business model, mobile phones, apps, tablet computers, books, and journalism. He had told Larry Ellison that his return strategy was to sell Next to Apple, get appointed to the board, and be there ready when CEO Gil Amelio stumbled. Ellison may have been baffled when Jobs insisted that he was not motivated by money, but it was partly true. He had neither Ellison's conspicuous consumption needs, nor Gates's philanthropic impulses, nor the competitive urge to see how high on the Forbes list he could get. Instead, his ego needs and personal drives led him to seek fulfillment by creating a legacy that would awe people. A dual legacy, actually, building innovative products and building a lasting company. He wanted to be in the pantheon with, indeed, a notch above people like Edwin Land, Bill Hewlett, and David Packard. And the best way to achieve all this was to return to Apple and reclaim his kingdom. And yet, when the cup of power neared his lips, he became strangely hesitant, reluctant, perhaps coy. He returned to Apple officially in January 1997 as a part-time advisor, as he had told Emilio he would. He began to assert himself in some personnel areas, especially in protecting his people who had made the transition from Next. But in most other ways, he was unusually passive. The decision not to ask him to join the board offended him, and he felt demeaned by the suggestion that he run the company's operating system division. Emilio was thus able to create a situation in which Jobs was both inside the tent and outside the tent, which was not a prescription for tranquility. Jobs later recalled, "Gil didn't want me around, and I thought he was a bozo. I knew that before I sold him the company. I thought I was just going to be trotted out now and then for events like Macworld, mainly for show. That was fine, because I was working at Pixar. I rented an office in downtown Palo Alto, where I could work a few days a week, and I drove up to Pixar for one or two days. It was a nice life. I could slow down, spend time with my family." Jobs was, in fact, trotted out for Macworld right at the beginning of January, and this reaffirmed his opinion that Emilio was a bozo. Close to 4,000 of the faithful fought for seats in the ballroom of the San Francisco Marriott to hear Emilio's keynote address. He was introduced by the actor Jeff Goldblum. "I play an expert in chaos theory in the Lost World Jurassic Park," he said. "I figure that will qualify me to speak at an Apple event." He then turned it over to Emilio, who came on stage wearing a flashy sports jacket and a banded collar shirt buttoned tight at the neck, looking like a Vegas comic, the Wall Street Journal reporter Jim Carlton noted, or in the words of the technology writer Michael Malone, "looking exactly like your newly divorced uncle on his first date." The bigger problem was that Emilio had gone on vacation, gotten into a nasty tussle with his speechwriters, and refused to rehearse. When Jobs arrived backstage, he was upset by the chaos and he seethed as Emilio stood on the podium, bumbling through a disjointed and endless presentation. Emilio was unfamiliar with the talking points that popped up on his teleprompter and soon was trying to wing his presentation. Repeatedly, he lost his train of thought. After more than an hour, the audience was aghast. There were a few welcome breaks, such as when he brought out the singer Peter Gabriel to demonstrate a new music program. He also pointed out Muhammad Ali in the first row. The champ was supposed to come on stage to promote a website about Parkinson's disease, but Emilio never invited him up or explained why he was there. Emilio rambled for more than 2 hours before he finally called on stage the person everyone was waiting to cheer. Jobs, exuding confidence, style, and sheer magnetism, was the antithesis of the fumbling Emilio as he strode on stage, Carlton wrote. The return of Elvis would not have provoked a bigger sensation. The crowd jumped to its feet and gave him a raucous ovation for more than a minute. The wilderness decade was over. Finally, Jobs waved for silence and cut to the heart of the challenge. "We've got to get the spark back," he said. "The Mac didn't progress much in 10 years, so Windows caught up. So we have to come up with an OS that's even better." Jobs's pep talk could have been a redeeming finale to Emilio's frightening performance. Unfortunately, Emilio came back on stage and resumed his ramblings for another hour. Finally, more than 3 hours after the show began, Emilio brought it to a close by calling Jobs back on stage and then, in a surprise, bringing up Steve Wozniak as well. Again, there was pandemonium. But Jobs was clearly annoyed. He avoided engaging in a triumphant trio scene, arms in the air. Instead, he slowly edged off stage. "He ruthlessly ruined the closing moment I had planned," Emilio later complained. His own feelings were more important than good press for Apple. It was only 7 days into the new year for Apple, and already it was clear that the center would not hold. Jobs immediately put people he trusted into the top ranks at Apple. "I wanted to make sure the really good people who came in from Next didn't get knifed in the back by the less competent people who were then in senior jobs at Apple," he recalled. Ellen Hancock, who had favored choosing Sun Solaris over Next, was on the top of his bozo list, especially when she continued to want to use the kernel of Solaris in the new Apple operating system. In response to a reporter's question about the role Jobs would play in making that decision, she answered curtly, "None." She was wrong. Jobs's first move was to make sure that two of his friends from Next took over her duties. To head software engineering, he tapped his buddy Avi Tavanian. To run the hardware side, he called on John Rubenstein, who had done the same at Next back when it had a hardware division. Rubenstein was vacationing on the Isle of Skye when Jobs called him. "Apple needs some help," he said. "Do you want to come aboard?" Rubenstein did. He got back in time to attend Macworld and see Emilio bomb on stage. Things were worse than he expected. He and Tavanian would exchange glances at meetings as if they had stumbled into an insane asylum, with people making deluded assertions while Emilio sat at the end of the table in a seeming stupor. Jobs did not come into the office regularly, but he was on the phone to Emilio often. Once he had succeeded in making sure that Tavanian, Rubenstein, and others he trusted were given top positions, he turned his focus onto the sprawling product line. One of his pet peeves was Newton, the handheld personal digital assistant that boasted handwriting recognition capability. It was not quite as bad as the jokes in Doonesbury comic strip made it seem, but Jobs hated it. He disdained the idea of having a stylus or pen for writing on a screen. God gave us 10 styluses, he would say, waving his fingers. Let's not invent another. In addition, he viewed Newton as John Scully's one major innovation, his pet project. That alone doomed it in Jobs' eyes. You ought to kill Newton, he told Emilio one day by phone. It was a suggestion out of the blue, and Emilio pushed back. What do you mean, kill it? He said. Steve, do you have any idea how expensive that would be? Shut it down, write it off, get rid of it, said Jobs. It doesn't matter what it costs. People will cheer you if you got rid of it. I've looked into Newton, and it's going to be a moneymaker, Emilio declared. I don't support getting rid of it. By May, however, he announced plans to spin off the Newton division, the beginning of its year-long stutter-step march to the grave. Tavanian and Rubenstein would come by Jobs' house to keep him informed, and soon much of Silicon Valley knew that Jobs was quietly wresting power from Emilio. It was not so much a Machiavellian power play as it was Jobs being Jobs. Wanting control was ingrained in his nature. Louise Kehoe, the Financial Times reporter who had foreseen this when she questioned Jobs and Emilio at the December announcement, was the first with the story. Mr. Jobs has become the power behind the throne, she reported at the end of February. He is said to be directing decisions on which parts of Apple's operations should be cut. Mr. Jobs has urged a number of former Apple colleagues to return to the company, hinting strongly that he plans to take charge, they said. According to one of Mr. Jobs' confidants, he has decided that Mr. Emilio and his appointees are unlikely to succeed in reviving Apple, and he is intent upon replacing them to ensure the survival of his company. That month, Emilio had to face the annual stockholders meeting and explain why the results for the final quarter of 1996 showed a 30% plummet in sales from the year before. Shareholders lined up at the microphones to vent their anger. Emilio was clueless about how poorly he handled the meeting. The presentation was regarded as one of the best I had ever given, he later wrote. But Ed Woolard, the former CEO of DuPont, who is now the chair of the Apple board, Markkula had been demoted to vice chair, was appalled. This is a disaster, his wife whispered to him in the midst of the session. Woolard agreed. Gil came dressed real cool, but he looked and sounded silly, he recalled. He couldn't answer the questions, didn't know what he was talking about, and didn't inspire any confidence. Woolard picked up the phone and called Jobs, whom he'd never met. The pretext was to invite him to Delaware to speak to DuPont executives. Jobs declined, but as Woolard recalled, the request was a ruse in order to talk to him about Gil. He steered the phone call in that direction and asked Jobs point blank what his impression of Emilio was. Woolard remembers Jobs being somewhat circumspect, saying that Emilio was not in the right job. Jobs recalled being more blunt. I thought to myself, I either tell him the truth, that Gil is a bozo, or I lie by omission. He's on the board of Apple. I have a duty to tell him what I think. On the other hand, if I tell him, he will tell Gil, in which case Gil will never listen to me again, and he'll fuck the people I brought into Apple. All of this took place in my head in less than 30 seconds. I finally decided that I owed this guy the truth. I care deeply about Apple, so I just let him have it. I said this guy is the worst CEO I've ever seen. I think if you needed a license to be a CEO, he wouldn't get one. When I hung up the phone, I thought, I probably just did a really stupid thing. That spring, Larry Ellison saw Emilio at a party and introduced him to the technology journalist Gina Smith, who asked how Apple was doing. You know, Gina, Apple is like a ship, Emilio answered. That ship is loaded with treasure, But there's a hole in the ship, and my job is to get everyone to row in the same direction." Smith looked perplexed and asked, "Yeah, but what about the hole?" From then on, Ellison and Jobs joked about the parable of the ship. When Larry relayed this story to me, we were in this sushi place, and I literally fell off my chair laughing, Jobs recalled. He was just such a buffoon, and he took himself so seriously. He insisted that everyone call him Dr. Emilio. That's always a warning sign. Brent Schlender, Fortune's well-sourced technology reporter, knew Jobs and was familiar with his thinking. And in March, he came out with a story detailing the mess. Apple Computer, Silicon Valley's paragon of dysfunctional management and fumbled techno dreams, is back in crisis mode, scrambling lugubriously in slow motion to deal with imploding sales, a floundering technology strategy, and a hemorrhaging brand name, he wrote. To the Machiavellian eye, it looks as if Jobs, despite the lure of Hollywood, lately he has been overseeing Pixar, maker of Toy Story and other computer-animated films, might be scheming to take over Apple. Once again, Ellison publicly floated the idea of doing a hostile takeover and installing his best friend Jobs as CEO. "Steve's the only one who can save Apple," he told reporters. "I'm ready to help the minute he says the word." Like the third time the boy cried wolf, Ellison's latest takeover musings didn't get much notice. So later in the month, he told Dan Gilmore of the San Jose Mercury News that he was forming an investor group to raise $1 billion to buy a majority stake at Apple. The company's market value was about $2.3 billion. The day the story came out, Apple stock shot up 11% in heavy trading. To add to the frivolity, Ellison set up an email address, saveapple@us.oracle.com, asking the general public to vote on whether he should go ahead with it. Jobs was somewhat amused by Ellison's self-appointed role. "Larry brings this up now and then," he told a reporter. "I try to explain my role at Apple is to be an advisor." Emilio, however, was livid. He called Ellison to dress him down, but Ellison wouldn't take the call. So Emilio called Jobs, whose response was equivocal but also partly genuine. "I really don't understand what is going on," he told Emilio. "I think all this is crazy." Then he added a reassurance that was not at all genuine. "You and I have a good relationship." Jobs could have ended the speculation by releasing a statement rejecting Ellison's idea, but much to Emilio's annoyance, he didn't. He remained aloof, which served both his interests and his nature. By then, the press had turned against Emilio. Business Week ran a cover asking, "Is Apple mincemeat?" Red Herring ran an editorial headlined, "Gil Emilio, please resign." And Wired ran a cover that showed the Apple logo crucified as a sacred heart with a crown of thorns and the headline, "Pray." Mike Barnicle of the Boston Globe, railing against years of Apple mismanagement, wrote, "How can these nitwits still draw a paycheck when they took the only computer that didn't frighten people and turned it into the technological equivalent of the 1997 Red Sox bullpen?" When Jobs and Emilio had signed the contract in February, Jobs began hopping around exuberantly and declared, "You and I need to go out and have a great bottle of wine to celebrate." Emilio offered to bring wine from his cellar and suggested that they invite their wives. It took until June before they settled on a date, and despite the rising tensions, they were able to have a good time. The food and wine were as mismatched as the diners. Emilio brought a bottle of 1964 Cheval Blanc and a Montrachet that each cost around $300. Jobs chose a vegetarian restaurant in Redwood City, where the food bill totaled $72. Emilio's wife remarked afterward, "He's such a charmer, and his wife is too." Jobs could seduce and charm people at will, and he liked to do so. People such as Emilio and Scully allowed themselves to believe that because Jobs was charming them, it meant that he liked and respected them. It was an impression that he sometimes fostered by dishing out insincere flattery to those hungry for it. But Jobs could be charming to people he hated just as easily as he could be insulting to people he liked. Emilio didn't see this because, like Scully, he was so eager for Jobs' affection. Indeed, the words he used to describe his yearning for a good relationship with Jobs are almost the same as those used by Scully. "When I was wrestling with a problem, I would walk through the issue with him," Emilio recalled. "Nine times out of ten, we would agree." Somehow he willed himself to believe that Jobs really respected him. "I was in awe over the way Steve's mind approached problems and had the feeling we were building a mutually trusting relationship." Emilio's disillusionment came a few days after their dinner. During their negotiations, he had insisted that Jobs hold the Apple stock he got for at least 6 months and preferably longer. That 6 months ended in June. When a block of 1.5 million shares was sold, Emilio called Jobs. "I'm telling people that the shares sold were not yours," he said. "Remember, you and I had an understanding that you wouldn't sell any without advising us first." "That's right," Jobs replied. Emilio took that response to mean that Jobs had not sold his shares, and he issued a statement saying so. But when the next SEC filing came out, it revealed that Jobs had indeed sold the shares. "Damn it, Steve, I asked you point blank about these shares, and you denied it was you." Jobs told Emilio that he had sold in a fit of depression about where Apple was going, and he didn't want to admit it because he was a little embarrassed. When I asked him about it years later, he simply said, "I didn't feel I needed to tell Gil." Why did Jobs mislead Emilio about selling the shares? One reason is simple. Jobs sometimes avoided the truth. Helmut Sonnenfeld once said of Henry Kissinger, "He lies not because it's in his interest. He lies because it's in his nature." It was in Jobs' nature to mislead or be secretive when he felt it was warranted. But he could also indulge in being brutally honest at times, telling the truths that most of us sugarcoat or suppress. Both the dissembling and the truth-telling were simply different aspects of his Nietzschean attitude that ordinary rules didn't apply to him.